Okay, so first, I should thank not just the organizers of the workshop for inviting me to speak, but the organizers of the entire semester for inviting me to stay for the entire semester. Very stimulating. So my title, I should say, is a little bit misleading for two reasons. It says a conjectural extension of the Gross-Daguerre theorem. It's not really a conjecture. I mean, it somehow was when I submitted the title, but now it's more like theorem minus epsilon. And of course, I'll explain what that means. And it's actually not technically an extension of the Gross-Daguerre theorem either. And I'll explain what that means as well. So it's all sort of ongoing work. With Jan Grenier and Tong Haiyang. And what this is supposed to be is essentially a very tiny little particular case of the conjectures that Steve laid out in the last talk. But somehow the easiest conceivable case, the case that's somehow so simple that you can actually prove everything. So let's fix the following data. So K is going to be a quadratic imaginary field. I want to keep everything to the simplest imaginable circumstances, so I'm going to assume that D, which is minus the discriminant of K, is an odd prime. And I'm even going to assume that K has class number 1. And these are somehow in no way essential, these are just for simplicity. I mean, really the hypothesis is just that D is odd. Okay, and n is going to be an integer, at least 2, and chi will be the quadratic character associated to k. So chi is the Legendre symbol minus d on blank. So the essential piece of data here is now going to be a choice of lambda, which is going to be a projective, well, free, since we're assuming class number 1, projective OK module of rank n minus 1, equipped with a perfect positive definite Hermitian form. So with a positive definite Hermitian form, that won't somehow appear much, but when it does, I'll call it H lambda. And perfect just means that it induces an isomorphism between lambda and its OK dual. So maybe unimodular is a more common word. And then from this Hermitian lattice, we can construct its representation numbers. So R lambda M is just going to be the number of times that this lattice represents the integer M. So the size of the set of all x and lambda such that H lambda xx is equal to M. And then, of course, it's a very classical fact that you can, if you assemble these numbers into a Q expansion, theta lambda of tau, sum over m greater than or equal to 0, r lambda m, q to the m, you get a modular form. And in fact, you get a modular form of weight n minus 1 on the group gamma 0 d with character chi to the n minus 1. Okay, so there's a modular form. Here's another modular form. Pick a modular form, F. So now that's going to be a cusp form of weight N, still on gamma 0 D, and now character chi to the n. And let's say that f has Fourier coefficients, sum over m greater than 0 of, say, am q to the m. So I'm not assuming anything about f. I'm not assuming that it's new or even an eigenform or anything at the moment. But there's absolutely nothing to stop me just from these formal q expansions forming just the formal Dirichlet series. I mean, just the Rankine-Selberg L function. So the sum for m of r lambda m a of m to the s. Which, of course, in this generality doesn't have any sort of Euler product or anything, but I can always, if I like, assume that f is an eigenform. The theta lambda will almost never be an eigenform, but I can always let the lattice vary and take linear combinations in order to produce eigenforms. The easiest way to do that is to just take all the lambdas in a fixed genus and just average over all those theta series. You'll get an eigenform. And then if they're both eigenforms, this will have an Euler product, and it'll have m of the continuation and a functional equation. And you can ask then about the derivative at the center point of the functional equation, which is n minus 1. And just ask, is there any meaning to this? Can you interpret this in some way? And of course, the reason you might expect there to be some interesting interpretation of this is because of the Gross-Auger theorem. Here in the situation of the Gross-Auger theorem, you would take n equals 2. You would take this projective OK module to just be OK with its unique positive definite Hermitian form satisfying this property. And then this L function would just be the base change L function of f to k. And of course, the Gross-Auger theorem asserts that then when you take the derivative, you get the height of a Higner point in the Jacobian. Right. So that's why I said at the beginning, it's not actually an extension of the Gross-Auger theorem. In the actual Gross-Auger setup, their level would satisfy the Higner hypothesis, which in particular would make it prime to the discriminant of the quadratic imaginary field, and I really want them to be equal. If you want the level to vary, that, there's probably something interesting one can say too, but at the moment, this is what we understand. There is, but if your question is somehow, do I know whether it's plus or minus 1? I don't know. So this is somehow, when I say theorem minus epsilon, this is the thing we don't know. I'm not asserting anything about the order of vanishing of this. And in this generality where, neither one is an eigenform, it's not even going to have a sign. But still, we can at least ask about this, and your question will become clearer toward the end. Okay, so where are we going to look for some sort of, obviously we want some sort of geometric candidate for the right-hand side, something appearing in the geometry of Shimura varieties. And so the Shimura varieties where we're going to look are the unitary ones that have appeared in essentially every talk so far this week. So MPQ, so this is going to be a stack over OK. It's going to be the moduli space of P plus Q dimensional abelian schemes, let's say A, with an action of OK, a principal polarization, which is OK linear, so an OK linear. That somehow means in the sense of Steve's talk, it's now compatible with the Rosati involution. OK linear principal polarization, and somehow the P plus Q, so PQ signature condition, I'm not going to write it down. I think it's appeared several times this week, but it's somehow specifying the way that OK acts on the Lie algebra. Signature condition on the OK action on the Lie algebra of the abelian scheme. And what would be something like a Hegner point on these guys? Well, here's the idea. So, oh, I have to do the thing, don't I? So what we're going to do is look at the map from M10 cross MN-10 to M10 cross MN-11. What's the map? So this is parametrizing pairs consisting of, so M10 is just the moduli space of elliptic curves with complex multiplication. So I have an elliptic curve with complex multiplication. I have some abelian variety of dimension N-1 with an OK action. And I just send that to the pair E, B. So I need something in the second slot of dimension N. So I just take B cross E bar, where E bar is just E, but you just change the action of OK. You just replace the action. You precompose it by complex conjugation. So E, but with the OK action conjugated. OK. You just sort of remember in the complex fiber, MPQ in the complex fiber has dimension P times Q. So this thing in the complex fiber is zero dimensional. And this thing is N-1 dimensional. And in fact, so this MN-10, it's not just somehow zero dimensional in the complex fiber. It's actually smooth of relative dimension zero over OK. And so if you want to understand what its irreducible components look like, you can just work in characteristic zero. And in characteristic zero, it's a question of linear algebra. And its connected components are naturally indexed by the possible lambdas that we could have chosen. Sorry? No. Not for signature N0. It's OK. It's just a problem with signature N1. For N0, it's OK. I mean, for PQ, I haven't said. For N0, it just means for, OK, you're happy already. So, yeah. I'm not claiming anything about the smoothness of this. Just N0. That one's OK. They're indexed by the possible lambda. So since we chose a lambda, we chose a connected component. What's that? Well, which? You mean here? I mean, every point on this moduli space is isogenous to a product of CM elliptic curves. Okay, so the component attached to our guy I'll keep call C lambda. And so now P lambda is just going to be M10 crossed with our fixed choice of components. And then, okay, this is mapping into M10 cross MN-1, and this thing has lots of connected components. But okay, so this P lambda, because of the class number one hypothesis, this stack, it has coarse moduli space, stack OK. So it's essentially just a point. And so its image lies on one connected component of this, and I'm going to call that connected component just N lambda. Okay. So what is it? I mean, like I said, in the complex fiber, it's just a single point. So, sorry?
Which part is just like, okay, is it P lambda?
No, the whole thing. The whole thing. I mean, this is, they're both spec okay, and then the fiber property is over okay.
Yeah.
So, it's a... Hey, you guys have lots of questions. It makes it more fun. Oh yeah, right. So the P lambda, so it's easy to write down what this thing is. So somehow P lambda based change. I mean, so I guess I'm thinking of P lambda, of course, as an OK valued point on here. And so if I fix an embedding of OK into C, where does this go? Well, okay, my quadratic imaginary field is class number one, so there's only one thing I could put in for E, and it's C mod OK. And what is B? Well, there's essentially an obvious choice. You take lambda, you tensor it up to the complex numbers, and now I have a complex vector space with a lattice inside of it, so I mod out by the lattice. And then I have to cross that by the complex conjugate of that thing, so C mod OK bar. So that's the point. It's like some kind of fake Hegner point, or bigger Hegner point, or it's more like a small Hegner point lost in this great big sea of large high-dimensional Schnorr variety. Okay. Next. Let me briefly write down the complex uniformization of M lambda. It already appeared in Steve's talk. So what you do is now I'm going to define L. So this is going to be some Hermitian lattice. I just take the lambda that I chose, and I tack onto it a copy L0. So L0 is just OK with the negative definite Hermitian form, minus x, y bar. And so this is now a Hermitian lattice of signature n minus 1, 1. And the complex points of m lambda are now x mod gamma, where gamma is just the unitary group associated to this lattice, so the automorphism group of L with its Hermitian form. And x is the space of negative lines in L complexified, one-dimensional complex vector spaces on which the Hermitian form is negative definite. And then in here, there's this Hegner point, and to tell you what it is, I just have to specify a gamma orbit of negative lines in L complexified, but, I mean, it was sort of, L was constructed so that it had a negative line inside of it, so that's it. So it's the gamma orbit of L0 complexified. Nothing could be easier. Okay, so now we've got something, on sort of arithmetically, this thing is dimension one. So now we want some cycles on M lambda of codimension one. These are exactly the ones that appeared in the previous talk. So Kudla and Rappaport call them special divisors, but I call them Kudla-Rappaport divisors. And, so the moduli definition appeared in the previous talk. So I'll just describe them in the complex fiber. They have a very elegant description. So if I'm given, let's say, a vector x in L with positive norm, so let's say the Hermitian form on here is going to be called Langle-Rangle. So I want it to have positive norm. You can define an analytic divisor on X. Oh, X was not a great choice, was it? Let me call it something else. Let me call it F, because in the moduli interpretation, it's actually a homomorphism. So D of F which is just defined as all those negative lines that are orthogonal to that vector. And then there's a divisor on the integral model. The divisor z of m on m lambda whose complex points are, you just sum over all the f in L of norm m, you take the corresponding divisor, and then you mod the whole thing out by gamma. So those are the divisors of the previous talk. There are some other divisors floating around that you can't avoid. It's sort of tempting to think of them as evil twins, except that's somehow unfair. They're not really evil so much as just kind of ugly. They're ugly twins or ugly cousins or something like that. They're defined in the same way, except you allow slight denominators in the lattice. So there's a similar z prime of m with complex points gamma mod the sum over f. Now I'll allow them to have a d in the denominator, d inverse L. I'm going to, in fact, insist that they have a d in the denominator, so not actually in the lattice of norm m, and apart from that, the definition is the same. Okay. Now, so following ideas of Borchard's Harvey and Moore and Vignier. So all of this is for orthogonal Shimura varieties. You can sort of imitate what they did in this unitary case in order to construct green functions for these divisors, which are not the same as the green functions of the previous talk. So the functions of the previous talk had some auxiliary parameter in them, and these don't. There's just a green function Cm for Zm, and a similar ugly cousin, C prime m, for Z prime m. And then these divisors on the integral model, together with these green functions, give you classes in the codimension 1 arithmetic Chow group, at least after you compactify m lambda, which you can do. So we get classes v hat m. And similar z hat prime m. And so now I can tell you sort of what the candidate is for the right-hand side of that, what you want to equate with the derivative of the Rankine-Cellberg-L function, except that sort of that's more of a plan. That's only plan A. So plan A would be the following. So first, this is only for m greater than 0. So first, you'd want to find the right definition of z hat 0. And then once you've found the right definition, you'd want to prove that if you take the formal generating series whose coefficients are these z hat m's, so I think in the last talk this was phi1. Is that phi? I'm just going to stick with what I have in my notes, which is the strikingly unoriginal z hat is the thing whose coefficients are z hat m. Prove that this is a modular form. in fact, of the same weight and level as that capital F. And then, if you knew that, you could define Z, okay, this is just bad notation, true, Z hat F to be the Petersen inner product of that generating series with F. And you take the Petersen inner product of a scalar valued form F with some modular form with values in here, and you get something in that arithmetic tau group. And then step four, and enjoy, where enjoy means try and relate that. I mean, that's not the hard part, but maybe that is the enjoyable part. Try and relate the derivative to, I mean, somehow I'll write it like this. The degree of this class along the Hegner point, where what this means is you take the tau hat 1 of M lambda, you pull back by the inclusion of P lambda into M lambda. P lambda is really just spec OK, and the tau hat 1 is really sort of pick hat, the space of metrized line bundles. So you're looking at metrized line bundles on spec OK, and that's just canonically the real numbers. It's especially easy to see when K has class number 1, because I mean, the only possible line bundle is the trivial one, and all of the possible metrics on it are just somehow, you can just scale the usual absolute value on the complex numbers, and then the scale factor gives you the isomorphism. So this composition is this degree, the degree along the Hegner point. So that's another target. I mean, except that at the moment, I mean, it's not like either one of these is sort of totally unapproachable, but they may be hard. I mean, or they may be not, but in any case, there's a plan B that lets you avoid proving 1 and 2, but still gives you the Z hat F. Okay, so I want to define the Z hat F without proving the modularity. And the way things are going, that's probably going to take me most of the rest of my time, unfortunately. So plan B. Plan B is something like whatever this Z hat F is, from the way that it's defined, you kind of imagine that it has to be inside this tau hat M lambda. It has to lie in the span of the Z hat M's. And if it's in the span of the Z hat M's, you could hope to just sort of write down the appropriate linear combination. Say what the linear combination is. It gives you this Z hat F. And that's basically what we're going to do. There's a funny complication, which is that it's actually not just the Z hat M's that appear. It's somehow what you should imagine is that if this is modular and this is Fourier expansion at the cusp infinity, you could take its Fourier expansion at a different cusp, and maybe you'll get some other divisors. And those are the ugly cousins, essentially. And so then the right linear combination is somehow going to involve the Fourier expansions, both of that thing and of F, at all of the different cusps, I mean, both of them, because we're on gamma 0 over prime, but still. And possibly in some very complicated way. And there's sort of a very slick way of packaging together all of the Fourier expansions at all of the cusps simultaneously. And that's to systematically work, not with scalar-valued modular forms, but with modular forms with values in some finite-dimensional representation of SL2Z. So here's how that works. So if I look at D inverse L mod L, this has a quadratic form. So it has a D inverse Z mod Z valued quadratic form Q, where Q of X is just you take the Hermitian form on L. And so I can define a finite dimensional vector space, F, as just all functions from the inverse L mod L to the complex numbers. But I'm only going to look at those functions that are invariant under the action of the orthogonal group of Q on that space, so fixed by the automorphism group of the quadratic form. Okay. And that space has a canonical basis in it. So not only a canonical basis, but even the canonical basis has a canonical element. So there's a basis consisting of E and some sort of ugly cousins of E, E prime M, where M runs over the element of the inverse V mod V. So E is just going to be the characteristic function of zero, so the zero coset. I mean, finding a basis just amounts to working out the orbits of vectors in this space under the automorphism group. And I mean, it's some old theorem of Witt that somehow, of course, the zero vector is one orbit, and two non-zero vectors lie in the same orbit, if and only if they have the same quadratic norm. So to get the other basis vectors, I should sum over all x in D inverse L mod L non-zero with Q of x equal to M of the characteristic function of that coset. So there's a basis. And there's an action of FL2Z on this vector space that's basically given by the Vey representation. So there's a Vey representation that I'll call rho. And also appearing are the contragradient representation. So it's just its complex dual. And sort of there's a complex conjugate representation acting on S bar, where S bar is just S, but rho bar gamma acting on some vector is, and the vectors are functions, so I take the complex conjugate of the function, let gamma act on that, and then take the complex conjugate again afterwards. So we've got three vector spaces, each with an action of SL2Z, and we're going to look at modular forms with values in those three vector spaces. So what have we got? So first, I mean, there's the tautological pairing between S and its dual, which I'm going to denote with braces. So S check cross S into C. I'm going to let S K rho be the space of holomorphic. I mean, it's supposed to be cusp forms of weight k, full level SL2Z, and representation rho. So holomorphic functions F from the upper half plane into S that transform like weight k modular forms. Well, gamma in SL2Z. And they should vanish at the cusp. I mean, somehow the important thing is that now there's only one cusp. Vanishes at infinity. And then there's an obvious... Peterson inner product. From, let's see, modular forms of weight n, now with values in the country gradient representation cross, I mean, maybe even not even cusp forms, but let's say modular forms here, and cusp forms of weight n with values in rho bar, given by the obvious formula, so the Petersen inner product of F and G, is you take F, you take G bar, and then you take the tautological pairing between them to get a scalar, and then you integrate that. D mu, du, dv over v squared, where tau is u plus iv. Okay. And we have to be able to go back and forth between scalar-valued forms and vector-valued forms. So there's an induction map from cusp forms of weight k on gamma 0 d and character chi to the d up to cusp forms of weight k with values in the representation rho bar given by the following formula. If I induce f, I take the sum over coset representatives mod gamma 0 d of f k slashed with gamma times rho bar gamma inverse times my distinguished vector b. And then there's a map the other way, a restriction map from sk gamma 0, sk rho check into sk gamma 0 d chi k. And this is just induced by the linear functional evaluation at E from F check to C. And finally, one more bit of notation before I can actually get to the point. We need not only holomorphic forms with values in these three vector spaces, we also need harmonic forms. So HK rho is going to be the space of now smooth functions F from the upper half plane into S. With the property that they transform like a weight k modular form. They're killed by the weight k hyperbolic Laplacian. And they're sort of weakly harmonic in the sense that they're allowed to have poles at the cusp. So what does a pole mean for a harmonic form? Well, they're supposed to be sort of meromorphic at infinity, which means the following. Meromorphic at infinity basically means I can subtract off a pole and get something with exponential decay. So in the sense that there exists a finite linear combination called the principal part of F. So it's going to be a sum over m greater than or equal to 0 of some a f m, how about a f minus m q to the minus m. It's a pole, a vector-valued pole. So the coefficients lie in S, such that F minus its principal part has exponential decay. Okay. At last, we can execute plan B. We need one more ingredient, which is the absolute essential thing. All of this ridiculous notation and these spaces of harmonic and holomorphic forms with values in these vector spaces is essentially so that I can state the following theorem of Brunier and Funke. Ah. Yeah, it's all SL2Z. Yeah, everything that's vector valued is at full level. Yeah. It's somehow the trade-off, like you go from scalar value to vector valued, but you only have one cusp now. The idea is supposed to be that if I take a scalar valued form and induce it and look at its Fourier coefficients, those are somehow encoding all of the Fourier coefficients at all of the cusps of the original thing, because you can see you're somehow summing over cosets that take infinity all around to the other cusps. At least that's how I think of it heuristically. If you ask me to somehow literally recover all the Q expansions from the one vector valued Q expansion, that would be a different thing altogether. So here's their theorem. I think this is totally cool. There is a differential operator. So it's complex antilinear. Xi. Xi takes a harmonic form of weight 2 minus n, which is typically negative, but I mean, I never actually said here that, I never said what k was. I mean, this actually makes perfect sense for negative weight. With values in S, so it has representation rho, going to cusp forms of weight n and representation rho bar, which by itself is not much of an assertion, satisfying two properties. So first, it's surjective, but it's even slightly better than surjective. So if I start with some vector valued F, there exists, oh, I want to call it probably capital F. There exists a harmonic little f that lifts it. And not only that, I can arrange that when I take the principal part of little f, it has no constant term. Okay. And two is somehow the punchline. If I start with a G of weight n and representation rho check, and I give myself a harmonic F of weight 2 minus n and representation rho, there's an explicit formula. Okay, so I can take my G, I can take the F, apply Xi to it to get one of these guys, and then take the Petersen inner product against G. And their theorem is an explicit formula for the Petersen inner product in terms of the Fourier coefficients of the original G and F. And the formula is you sum over all M greater than or equal to zero, you take the, okay, so this F is gonna have principal part, the way I wrote it before, the sum over m greater than or equal to 0, af minus m, q to the minus m. I have to call the Fourier coefficients of g something, so let's call it sum over m of b m q to the m. And the Petersen inner product is you take the coefficients here, and you take the coefficients of the principal part, and you just pair them under the tautological pairing between S check and S, and you add the results up. which is amazing. Why is that amazing? Because imagine we're in the following hypothetical situation. We have some sort of cusp form living here, and we want to take its Petersen enterprise against some G that we're given as a Q expansion, and we only suspect that it's a modular form, but we don't know it. And we want to take the form of Petersen inner product. What do? You take your cusp form, you lift it back to a harmonic form, just write it in this way, and then you use the right-hand side to define the Petersen inner product, because the only thing that appears are the Fourier coefficients. Right? The only thing here are just the Fourier coefficients of G. The right-hand side doesn't care if G is modular or not. So we just have to apply this to our slightly more elaborate situation. Ah, right. So, but if the constant term is zero, not only do I not need to know that G is modular, I don't even need to know what the constant term of G is because it doesn't appear in the formula. I can have a formal Q expansion where I don't know the constant term, suspect that it's modular, and still form the Petersen inner product this way. The only catch, I mean, obviously there's some penalty for not proving the modularity, and the penalty is that, I want to start by forming the Petersen inner product of G against something here, and I don't know that G is modular, then this right-hand side may a priori depend on the lift that I get. So maybe I don't care. In fact, I don't care, fortunately. So, recall we have this basis, E, and its evil cousins, ugly cousins, whatever they are. This is our basis of S. Okay, there's a dual basis, E check, together with E prime M check, not the best notation. So now I can sort of put everything together. And construct the following. So this is going to be a formal Q expansion. With coefficients. Now not just, I mean, our old Z hat had coefficients in Chow hat 1 and lambda. Now it's going to be in that space tensored with S check. It's supposed to be somehow an augmented version of z hat, so I think I'll call it z tilde. And it's defined as, I've been a little sloppy about when I write things like m greater than or equal to 0 and m less than or equal to 0. Are they integers? Somehow not always. I mean, sometimes they're in D inverse Z, sometimes I'm allowing denominators without saying so. This is defined as the sum over m greater than 0 for m an integer of our z hat m, and I have to tensor with some vector, so I just tensor with the vector e hat. But then I'm going to add to it the sum over m greater than 0, now m in D inverse Z, and somehow all of the ugly cousin stuff goes into this term. So Z prime M hat tensor E prime M hat. So that's my definition. Just add that stuff up. Oh, yeah. Q to the M, Q to the M. Thank you. And then this sum, I'll just give a name to the coefficients. This is now going to be the sum over M, just collect all the common terms together, and I'll call it something like Y hat M, Q to the M. So now the Y hat M's live in this space. And this is somehow constructed so that first, it should be actually a modular form, in some sense, the values here. I mean, it should be a modular form on SL2Z for the representation rho check. And remember, there was this restriction map from vector-valued forms to scalar-valued forms, which was, evaluation at E, if I evaluate at E, all of this stuff goes away. This becomes 1, and I just get the z hat that I started with. So evaluation at E from S check to C takes this z tilde to z hat. So here we go. I now start with my F, the guy that I started out with at the very beginning, in Sn gamma 0 d chi to the n. I induce that, I promote it to a vector valued form with values in the representation rho bar. And then I have this differential operator, xi, from the harmonic forms, weight n minus 2, representation rho, to there. And I just pick a lift, little f. And now you can somehow do this formal calculation. So under plan A, this z hat f was defined as the Petersen inner product between z hat and f. This z hat f is now, because of that, the restriction of z tilde. And I didn't say this before, but the restriction and induction are adjoint with respect to the Petersen inner product. So I can adjoint it over. And then when I induce f, that's the same as the c of little f. And then by the Brunier-Funke formula, that's the sum over m greater than or equal to 0 of the y hat of m. Well, okay, so when I choose this f, I'm going to choose its constant term to be 0. So I just over m greater than 0 of the pairing between y hat m and the minus m coefficient in the principal part of f. And this is now some element in chow hat 1 and lambda. And the right-hand side is defined unconditionally without any kind of knowing the modularity of the generating series. So now plan B is just define it this way. So this is plan B definition. So that was, oh God, 55 minutes since to give you a definition. That wasn't quite supposed to work out that way, but, oh, I still have this other board, don't I? And a priori, this definition depends on the choice of little f. But if you believe the modularity of that generating series z hat, then in fact it doesn't depend on the choice at all. So now the conjecture is that z hat of f is independent of the choice of little f. What can we prove about it? So here's the theorem. Well, I mean, it's what we want, minus epsilon. So what does the minus epsilon mean? So there is a weight 1 Eisenstein series E tau f of level gamma 0 d and character chi such that, so it satisfies a functional equation in f goes to minus s. forces it to vanish at s equals 0. And somehow more importantly, if I take this class defined in this way, and I take its degree with respect to the Hegner point, the result is you take the Petersen inner product of the cusp form with the product of the theta series associated to lambda, and the derivative, well, let me write, so this is the Petersen inner product, and then you take the derivative evaluated at s equals 0. Okay. So, in particular, this function here on the right-hand side, whatever it is as a function of f, has analytic continuation in a functional equation because it inherited from the Eisenstein theory. Yes. And somehow, whatever this function is, well, its derivative at s equals 0 is given by essentially this kind of generalized type pairing. So, I mean, here's the last thing to show is that, I mean, okay, of course, this looks like the usual Rankine-Selberg integral. And so, and the only thing left is to compare them. And you sort of think, well, okay, there's a shift. So this is like, L, F, theta chi, S plus N minus 1. And isn't that to somehow exactly the original Rankine-Selberg method? Yes, of course it is. But somehow you should imagine, remember this F now in this generality is not a new form or an eigenform or anything. But now imagine we make it a new eigenform. Imagine we sum over the lambdas in some fixed genus so that the theta lambda becomes an eigenform as well. Then somehow both sides of this are going to have an Euler product. And those Euler factors are going to agree everywhere, except there's going to be something funny happening at our single ramified prime D. So essentially, these are going to be equal up to some local factor at D. I mean, in Wei Zhang's talk yesterday, there were all these assertions that various things were equal up to some local factors, and what he never mentioned at any point was exactly when those local factors were zero or not zero, which is somehow a very subtle question. So, I mean, our final theorem is going to be this is equal to the derivative of this L function under some hypotheses, and the hypotheses will be exactly what you need to make the local factor non-zero. But at this point, we've reduced it down to just some local calculation that we just have to do. I mean, it's not clear how hard it'll be. The point is more that this theorem is only about 2 weeks old, and so and give us another 2 weeks, and that might be enough. And I'll stop there. Thank you. Something about it. I don't know, what would you like me to say about it? I mean, one thing I can say, and it's actually somehow part of the proof, is that there's a paper of Kudla, Rappaport, and Yang called On the Derivative of an Eisenstein Series of Weight 1. It's precisely that Eisenstein series. The point is that somehow what I want to do is take, let's say, Q So let's let sort of V equal K with its Hermitian form. Minus x, y bar. So this is sort of a negative definite Hermitian space. And you sort of make it incoherent by defining a collection of V, L for L less than or equal to infinity by saying that this V, L is just V completed at L if L is finite. But then at the Archimedean place, I'm just going to switch to the positive definite Hermitian form. So I'll write minus VL if L is equal to infinity. And then somehow that script V is just the product of all these VLs. So this is what Steve would call an incoherent Hermitian space. And because we switched the factor at infinity, it doesn't, this product of Hermitian spaces is not the idealization of any Hermitian space over K, right? And the point is what? So the point is that there's a Vey representation of SL2 acting on the short space of this. And I mean, you have to, this is turning into too long of an answer to a question. I mean, there's a sort of a distinguished element of this short space, which is basically at every finite place, you take the characteristic function of OK sitting inside of here, and then at the Archimedean place, you take some kind of Gaussian. So there's some distinguished, let's say, phi in this short space. So this is the Vey representation, omega. And then you take, for G in SL2 of the Adels, you look at omega of G, you let it act on that short space, you evaluate it at zero. And this, as a function on SL2A, is this is an element in some principal series. So it's like the principal series somehow induced from chi. And then, I mean, you sort of extend to a standard section in I, chi, absolute value, Cs. And then you form an Eisenstein series from this section, and somehow in the usual way, by summing over the cosets of the upper triangular matrices. I mean, this is somehow exactly the same kind of Eisenstein series that were appearing in Steve's talk. Just somehow in this very, very special case, where you just have this rank one Hermitian space and an action of SL2 on the Schwarz functions. But I mean, if you want to know what this thing is, so now the real answer, as I told you, look in that paper of Kudla, Rappaport, and Yang, where this Eisenstein series appears in the title, and the paper is essentially about that Eisenstein series. So. Of course. I mean, what does the proof really amount to? In one way or another, it amounts to essentially the same thing that Gross and Zagier proved. I mean, you want to compute. So to compute this z hat f, the degree of that, it's defined as some linear combination of the z hat m's. So you want to compute all of those. And what is it? Well, I mean, what we end up proving is somehow exactly what Gross and Zagier proved. You take this modular form, you take a polymorphic projection, and then you take the nth Fourier coefficient of that. And somehow. Yes, sure, absolutely. In fact, somehow the methods aren't even the same. I mean, at a crucial point, somehow if you just take it's the actual scheme-theoretic intersection of this and this, and look at the moduli problems, you can somehow decompose it as some disjoint union of K plus L equals M, and then a disjoint union over the vectors in our lattice of norm K, and then somehow some zero cycle Y of L. What is this? This is the divisors appearing in your book. These are the moduli spaces of I guess you call them Z too. But I mean, this is a moduli space actually just of elliptic curves with quaternionic multiplication. I mean, it's OK. So elliptic curves with an action of the order OK adjoined T, where T squared is equal to minus L, and T sort of anti-commutes with the complex multiplication. So I mean, at least for the proper part of the intersection, somehow you can see already, I mean, the result of the paper on the derivative of the Waitman Eisenstein series. I mean, it's the same zero-dimensional space. And what's the result of that paper? It's that if you take this zero-dimensional thing, count up the number of points with multiplicities including going through the local rings, you get the Fourier coefficients of this Eisenstein series. And so somehow this thing is matching up with the coefficients here. And then in here, I mean, this thing inside doesn't depend on x. So this is just a whole bunch of copies of this. How many is it? It's just the representation number, lambda, not L. It's the number of times that this lattice represents k. So you can start to see, if you take the product of these and then compute its m Fourier coefficient, you're summing over k plus L equals m of the kth coefficient of this and the lth coefficient of this, which exactly mirrors this decomposition. And that's essentially everything for the proper intersection. I mean, at least the finite part. And then, of course, it gets more interesting from there. I meant to somehow finish the construction of Z hat M about 20 minutes earlier than I did, and then I would have said a lot more about the intersection. Sorry about that.